Hello, my name is Art Hansen, and I'm a professor emeritus from Cal State University at Fullerton, where I taught for 42 years and started out as a specialist in British and American intellectual history and did that for a number of years. And in the early 70s, I switched my focus to studying Japanese-American World War II experience.
And so,
if you're in the session entitled, In My Parents' Words, Voices from Department of Justice Camps, you're in the right place. If you have another name for your session, you're in the wrong place. Okay. This particular session was included in this conference for several reasons. We wanted to underscore the fact that the first-person voices that have been telling us for years the camp stories are starting to be lost, and they're lost because the people with those voices have passed away or they have become, you know, infirm for one or another reasons. So the story is now being passed along to other generations. We have three people here today who were all in Department of Justice camps, but what they're going to be telling are their parents' stories, and they have particular sources by which they can carry on their parents' stories. So they're acting as go-betweens. And the first of these go-betweens is Satori Ichikawa. And Satori Ichikawa was born in 1929, and he was about 12 years old when Pearl Harbor occurred. And when the war came along, he went to the Minidoka camp, which we now call not an internment camp, but we call a concentration camp. And this gets down to another reason for this particular session. A lot of people don't know about the internment camps and the propriety of the use of the word internment. And so that's going to be part and parcel of this presentation as well. Satori came from a family that had two generations, both his father and his mother came from families in which there were like 16 to 17 generations of Buddhist priests. And his father was a Buddhist priest in Seattle at the Seattle Buddhist Church, and they had just built a new temple when the war broke out and set in motion the World War II experience of Japanese Americans in concentration camps and in internment centers, as we will find out. And Satoru, after the war, went to college at the University of Washington, and he got a degree in commercial art, and he had a career in that particular field. But I don't want to encroach upon his wartime story, so I will let him tell it. Okay?
Thank you very much, Dr. Larson. I have a sort of a rough throat, so I may have speaking problems, also hearing problems. After all, I am now almost 84 years old. Well, okay, let's get started here. In My Parents' Words, Issei Voices from Department of Justice Camps, and letters, photos, and documents of the Ichikawa family during World War II. My father was the resident minister of the Seattle Buddhist Church. The construction of the temple on 14th and Main was nearing completion. It carried a heavy mortgage and payments had to be made. A cornerstone laying ceremony was held on March 16, 1941. These jubilant members had no idea that World War II would start later that year to disrupt their lives. War broke out between Japan and the U.S. with the bombing of Pearl Harbor, Hawaii on December 7, 1941. Dad was arrested by the FBI in the spring of 1942. Here's his mugshot. With all the church leaders and members evacuated due to Executive Order 9066, the temple was leased to the U.S. Maritime Service and used as its district headquarters to shelter staff and trainees. The family was separated from Dad during the first 2 years of the war. The map shows our family's travels. He was sent to Fort Missoula, Montana, Camp Livingston, Louisiana, and Santa Fe, New Mexico. He was considered a dangerous enemy alien, along with many other Issei community leaders. We, in turn, were taken to the Puyallup Assembly Center and later to Minidoka, Idaho. My mother and seven children, from the youngest at 4 months to me at 12 years, was bused to Camp Harmony, Puyallup, Washington. We brought only what we could carry. We spent 3 months in Area C by the fairgrounds, a large parking lot hastily converted into a camp with barbed wire, fence, and armed guards in watchtowers 24/7. After 3 months in Puyallup, we were moved by train to a WRA prison camp in the dusty, lonely, sagebrush country of Minidoka, Idaho. The family gathered in front of the Minidoka barracks at Block 13-1E with two friends, Mr. Y. Suzuki and Mr. R. Hino. My mother carries the youngest son. I'm the boy standing to the left by the door. An official camp photographer snapped this photo. We were not allowed to bring cameras into camp. Since Dad was miles apart from us, letters were the only means of communication. These were all censored. Some 85 letters were from Dad. 19 were saved from Mom's collection. Obviously, Dad had more time to write than Mom, who was busy taking care of 7 kids. The letters described the conditions in camp, how Mom and Dad felt about incarceration, their hopes to be reunited, and thoughts about their children's welfare. I've also included documents that help describe the events. Red arrows and underlines point to important passages. The first letter Dad sent was written on July 2, 1942, from Fort Missoula, Montana. Note, red underline. He received a notice from the Selective Service, forwarded to him from Mom. I'm sorry I don't have a copy of that one. It may have notified him of his draft status. This one is from Fort Missoula, Montana, dated July 31, 1942. Note that the censor cut out 3 words in the letter. There's a censor stamp in the lower left corner with the words, "Detained Alien Enemy Mail," examined by the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service. Censorship was eased when the tides of war turned to the Allies' favor. Here's one from Camp Livingston, Louisiana, an Army camp. He has some initial thoughts about repatriating to Japan. I received a letter written by Satoru yesterday. No need so hurry to answer about repatriation. As I have intention to repatriate, I reported my intention to you, but I'm now thinking over my responsibility. And later on he says, "Can you get a pair of guitar clogs, Japanese guitar? If so, please send to me, as I must walk to the shower bath in this camp," and then a censored portion of the letter. He writes about repatriation again, but feels he owes a heavy responsibility to the Seattle Temple. He must complete the job he had set out to do. The church carries a large mortgage that must be paid off. He will contact Mr. Ito president, and other directors of the temple. And the lower part of the letter says, I'm hoping that we get together again, even one day sooner while we are all well. Oh, this, you know, I kind of skipped a place here. Yeah, this is Mom's letter to Dad. Mom's letter to Dad, written in script Japanese. It's difficult for me to translate. I did the best I could so that my siblings could learn what Mom wrote. The censor had to know the Japanese language and what to cut out. I took some liberties in the translation. Here's a blow-up of that letter. Mom expresses her private feelings and hopes for the family to reunite. In other lines, tonight I dreamed of you returning, and I was happy and laughing when I woke up and realized it was a dream. I had a lonely feeling. I'm waiting for the day we can all be together again. Mom writes about the Obon service in Block 14. Whenever there's a service, I think about you. It's unexplainable, but I feel that you are somehow present. And on the last paragraph, I'm hoping that we get together again, even one day sooner, while we are all well. Well, then I'll excuse myself with this today. Please take care. Mom expresses her thoughts. These days I dream about you every night. At least I feel fortunate I can meet you in my dreams. Doctors were scarce in camp, and there's a rumor that an excellent doctor, Dr. Hashiba, will arrive soon. In Camp Livingston, Louisiana, Dad used government-issued mailing forms with the words, prisoner of war, printed on the face. He had to cross out the words, prisoner of war, and write in internee of war. The government went to great lengths to call us voluntary internees or detainees rather than prisoners of war. Here are others that my dad received. Akira, my young brother, age 5, colored in the drawings furnished by Reverend H.E. Terao in the camp Sunday school. Note the censor's stamp on a child's picture. I mailed him this one, showing the old-timers' softball game. I drew in the Minidoka Water Tower in the distance. I asked him if he enjoyed playing golf. Dad wrote he played golf in the Santa Fe camp with other Issei prisoners. Would that make Mom a golf widow? A Red Cross letter for Dad from Grandfather in Japan, dated August 23, 1943, during the heat of the war. It reads in Japanese, Kazoku mina kenzai nari ya, toho buji nari, anshin seyo. Roughly translated, we are all well here, so don't worry. These Issei inmates were all from Nagano-ken Prefecture in Japan. My father is seated in the second row to the extreme right in black jacket and work pants. At front row right is Hamao Hirabayashi, an uncle of Gordon Hirabayashi, the University of Washington student who challenged the curfew during the early days of the war and was jailed for breaking it. Gordon was later exonerated in a celebrated case and was awarded the President's Medal of Freedom. Dad asked the Santa Fe camp authorities for temporary parole to visit the family in Minidoka. The children, especially the youngest two, were seriously sick in the hospital. The request was denied. However, the camp authorities must have realized the extreme hardship the separation of family creates. It may have helped us to be reunited in the Crystal City, Texas camp. Mom writes to Dad that the two youngest kids were sick in the hospital, and the nurse told her they were in no shape to travel. we may have to delay the much-awaited reunion. She adds, quick to act, Satoru has already packed all his baggage to go. Then she writes, I'm sorry to make you worry, but these are the conditions presently, so please excuse me. This is the last letter Dad mailed to us from Santa Fe. He writes, when do you expect to leave there for Crystal City? I expect that we can reunite soon after 2 years of separation. I drew this map of Crystal City Family Reunion Center. It shows the layout of the camp. The red arrow points to the barracks we occupied. The Department of Justice camp was also surrounded by barbed wire fence and guard towers. It imprisoned not only Japanese families, but German families and a few Italians. It had American and Japanese schools. I attended both. This document, dated November 7, 1945, instructed Dad to appear for a hearing. It gave him an opportunity to oppose his deportation to Japan. It provided for a family member, namely me, to testify in his behalf. I told the panel that Dad never was disloyal. He always taught us to respect our country. Many of his former Sunday school kids were now fighting for our country. The result of the hearing shaped our lives. I must have given them a favorable impression since he was released. This important letter instructed us that we were free to return to Seattle. We were voluntarily interned. It tells Dad, Mr. Ishikawa, you are further advised that it will be necessary that you report to your draft board immediately upon arrival in regard to your change of address and occupation. The American Promise. This document officially apologizes for the internment of Japanese Americans. Our government made a mistake in doing so. It brings to a close Executive Order 9066 and promises that this type of action shall not be repeated, signed by President Gerald R. Ford in the bicentennial year of our country.
You know, that was such a wonderful presentation, and it's interesting that his interview, if you want to access more about his experience, he did an interview with Tommy Ketta for Dencho. So if you go to Dencho and get Satoru's interview, I think you'll find it captivating. One of the things about it was he was asked by Tommy, he said, you know, you came from a mother and a father who were from 16 and 17 unbroken generations of priests, and you didn't become a priest. Did you have any pressure put on you? He said, no, I didn't have any pressure put on me. He said, I wanted to be an artist. Now, as an artist, he drew such a beautiful picture of Crystal City. That will appear in book after book after book. It's really something he could probably use for retirement income. It's really great. The next panelist, Satsuki Ina, was born in camp, and she was born in the Tule Lake Segregation Center. And she was born in 1944, and I almost was killed when I asked her earlier before this started, you were born in 1943, right? No, don't make me any older. Well, we're not. In fact, I will hedge on it and say she was born in 53 in camp. Okay. Girl Scout camp. Okay. She is very well known for several things. One, she was a professor in education at Sacramento State. She's also had for a long time a practice as a psychotherapist, and she is a filmmaker, and she's had two great films. Both of them are rooted in her family experience. One is The Children of the Camps and From a Silk Cocoon. If you haven't seen them, do. If you are in any position to use them anywhere, buy them and show them. If neither of those, just encourage other people, based on our say-so, that they should get them. Are they available out there?
Yeah,
for
they're
sale?
At the Elliott Bay bookstall.
Okay, good. Great. Go to the Elliott Bay bookstall out there in the lobby and you can get it. Her parents were both Kibbeh, and I'm not quite sure, and maybe you could explain this, Satsuki. Were they in Tule Lake before they were they in Topaz?
They were in Topaz first.
When they went from Topaz to Tule Lake when it became a segregation center.
Right.
And then did your mother stay with you
yes.
in Tule Lake when your father went off to Fort Lincoln and then in Bismarck and then to Santa Fe and then to Crystal City and then you and your mom joined him in Crystal City. Okay. So
he didn't exactly went off. He was dragged.
Yeah, dragged off. Yeah, I don't mean went off. I mean, let's just say involuntarily.
Right.
I mean, we did have some language about voluntary there. We want to make this clear, especially when she starts talking about proper terminology. I mean, I remember the first time I got corrected on improper terminology by Roger Daniels, and he said, Art, he said, stop using the word evacuation. He said, you evacuate your bowels. You don't evacuate people. So, okay. So, that's it.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Art. I'd like to share with you a little background about my father's experience. It started when I went to, Redress passed in 1988, and I went to the Smithsonian exhibit to see the presentation called We the People. And I walked in looking to be educated, turned the corner, and there's a large picture of my father there. And although it's kind of a blurred image, I recognized him immediately. So I want you to just keep in mind the T-shirt. This is a now confirmed the Tule Lake Jail, and you could see in this photograph that there are I had this little thing, but it doesn't work. I stole it from my cat, and she must have made sure that I didn't. But that's the cell at Tule Lake, which we're working on now to preserve. And so small jail, there's two beds on one side, two beds on the other side. You could see a man sitting on the toilet in the far right-hand corner, and my father standing in front of the cell door. So when I saw that picture, I was stunned and really in disbelief because my father had never talked about his experience, and he had been gone 12 years when Redress was passed. So by the time I finished walking through the exhibit, I had resolved to find out more about his story. So struggling to survive as a tenant rice farmer in Yamanashi Prefecture, my grandfather, Takizo, and his brother flipped a coin to decide which one would go to South America and which one would go to North America. My grandfather arrived in San Francisco in 1890, married the Shashin Hanayome, picture bride, Aiko Nakayama, who was from the same Nagano Prefecture. And Itaru was born in San Francisco in 1913. His younger sister was frail and sickly, so it was decided that Aiko would return to Yamanashi with the children, and Takizo would continue his work at the Japanese newspaper in San Francisco and send money home. Itaru attended school in Japan. And when he was 16, his parents feared he would be drafted into the Japanese military, so he was sent to America to live with his father. Itaru entered high school, and not long after, his father became ill and returned to Japan and soon passed away. So this is one of the stories of a Kibbeh. So Kibbeh means to return to America. He's an American citizen. But for various reasons, people were sent back to Japan and returned. Being a Kibbeh essentially excluded my father from Nisei life in San Francisco because Japanese was his primary language. And when his father died, he was left in the care of family friends. I love this photo because that's the family friend with the white beard holding an American flag. He learned to fend for himself and found comfort and camaraderie with other Nisei Kibbeh. Very handsome dudes. Yeah. He studied the shakuhachi, He was very active in the San Francisco Buddhist Church, participated in Japanese theatrical performances. That's him. And then my favorite one. Itaru was 26 when he met my mother at the 1939 World's Fair on Treasure Island in San Francisco. My mother Shizuko was also a Kibe born in Seattle, raised in Nagano Prefecture after her mother died in childbirth. She was one of the silk girls demonstrating Japanese silk reeling in the Japan Pavilion. They met, fell in love, and Shizuko returned from Japan to marry Itaru. They were married in the San Francisco Bukyokai in March of 1941. 9 months later, December 7, 1941, Japan attacks Pearl Harbor, and within months of President Roosevelt's executive order, Shizuko and Itaru are restricted by curfew and then forcibly removed along with all persons of Japanese ancestry from the West Coast. This is a photo that was taken by Dorothea Lange in San Francisco. And you can see in the background the notices of the removal of the Japanese. She's in line here to get her assigned family number. They're first removed to Tanforan Racetrack Detention Center, where Shizuko suffered morning sickness while living in converted horse stalls. After 6 months, they are transferred to more permanent quarters in Topaz Concentration Camp near Delta, Utah. My brother Kiyoshi is born here. When the so-called loyalty questionnaire was imposed, my father was outraged by the obvious injustice, and at a Kibe meeting, he spoke and said simply, "We should be treated equal to the free people," advocating not registering until their freedom was returned. Then I was born in Tule Lake. Subsequently charged with sedition, and answering no, no, my parents and my brother were sent to Tule Lake Concentration Camp, a maximum security segregation center for those identified as disloyal. It was here that I was born. Further disheartened by their life in camp and fearful of their children, Itaru and Shizuko decide to renounce their American citizenship with hopes to return to Japan for a better life. With worsening living conditions, unrest growing in camp, along with increasing protest and dissidence reflected in the internal conflict among the prisoners, my parents joined the Hoshidan, and entries in their diaries reflect both their despair and their future in America, both their despair about their future in America and solace in returning to Japan. Seeking to rid themselves of so-called troublemakers and the disloyal, euphemisms applied to those who dissented and demanded better treatment, the administration moved aggressively and sometimes violently to remove Hoshidan leaders to prisons, DOJ internment camps, or deportation to Japan, separating the men from their community and family. And my mother referred to herself in her letters as one of the internment widows. This is the Hoshidan marching morning exercises and rituals. And the Hoshidan were characterized as pro-Japan loyalists and militarists, and also viewed by many of the other Japanese Americans as violent and criminal in nature. With increasing dissidence and polarization of the prisoners, administration between loyal versus disloyal, camp administration outlawed all Hoshidan activities that had been previously condoned. Tule Lake was viewed as a segregation center, and there were Japanese schools and these rituals and celebration of the emperor were all viewed by the administration as part of preparation for people who were going back to Japan. And then they reversed their actions, and as dissidents increased in the camps, and all Hoshidan activities became illegal. And the records that I gathered about my father indicate that he was arrested for engaging in the Hoshidan morning ritual, where marching and the overt loyalty to the emperor were expressed. In And these are archival photos that were surreptitiously taken, showing the removal of the Hoshidan leaders. The photo I had discovered at the Smithsonian of my father in the Tule Lake Jail where he was held. You could see the train. This is also an archival photo of the Hoshidan leaders being removed in the winter. My father was removed in July. He was not one of the first group of leaders removed, but of the 100 that were later removed in the summer. So when the first group of the Hoshidan leaders were removed, then people in the lower ranks moved up to maintain the leadership and organization. And the last group to be removed included my father. So here's that picture that I saw at the Smithsonian. And when I researched at the National Archives, I was able to retrieve my father's mugshot taken upon his arrival at Fort Lincoln, which was after he had been held in the Tule Lake Jail. And here's his mugshot. And what I was struck by is if you examine this photo closely, you could see that he's got bruises and cut marks and his lip is split. And it's well known that the Hoshidan leaders that were held in Tule Lake were often victims of brutal violence. So he was transferred, kicking and screaming, to Fort Lincoln in Bismarck, North Dakota. He often wrote in his haiku journal about temperatures below zero compared to, and yet the luxury compared to the federal, comparing the federal internment camp in contrast to Tule Lake where his family was held. And soldiers returning from the battlefield would come and visit families, and that was the only time that they could have photos taken. And this is the photo of us, my brother and myself and my mother remaining in Tule Lake. So they were separated for 18 months and exchanged, just like Mr. Ichikawa talked about, exchanged letters that were under the prying eyes of government censors. And communication was strained and often during the threat of my father's possible deportation, there was a lot of misunderstanding and grief because the letters had been so cut up. In one letter, my mother writes a postscript on her letter saying, "Dear censor, for the sake of my children, please do not cut this letter." And it's one of the few letters that was not cut. Fortunately, not only did I have to depend on the letters that they exchanged, there were 182 letters that I found that my parents had preserved. And they had also kept daily diaries of their true and honest feelings about their experiences because those were the writings that were not going to be under the eyes of the censor. In addition, they exchanged secret letters stripped from bed sheets and sewn into my father's pants, sent back and forth for repair. So he would strip his bed sheet, write the letters, and then fold it up and put it inside the belt lining and stitch it back up. And sometimes they were on the inside of the pants pocket. And especially when the potential of my father repatriating, there were a lot of men who actually repatriated without their families from the DOJ camps, thinking that Japan had been victorious and that later their families would follow. And my mother was terrified that that's what my father might do out of his anger. So these letters reflect that. My father wrote hundreds of haiku during his time of incarceration in Bismarck, Santa Fe, and Crystal City, and wrote in these notebooks. This is the one from Bismarck. And so at the top, he would keep his journal, and in the bottom, he would write his first draft of his haiku, which he would rework many times. So I'm going to just take the last few minutes here to read to you some of the haiku that he wrote. I'm not going to read the Japanese portion because my Japanese sucks. But I put them there so you could see domaji. You could see my father stuck pretty much to the traditional 5-7-5 syllables and also included the kigo, which is the haiku seasonal term that's used so that the implication of the time of the year that he wrote the poem. So this is what he wrote while he was in the Tule Lake jail. I'm leaving, but the suntan child doesn't know. Brisk moon through the window's iron bars, mountains, and rivers. The iron door is closed. The guards have all gone. Moths dance around the light. The day dawns early at the prison window, a single star. A moth danced, inscribing a shadow on the inmate's face. I go out the prison door, mountains and rivers cleared out of early summer rain. It's the first time he'd been outside of the confines of Tule Lake, en route to Bismarck. The daytime moon following a bus, summer journey. Approaching a snowy valley, the breeze cools at the train window. The station is hot. There's hatred in the eyes looking at me. Then he arrives in Bismarck. Rain falls. Wilted leaves fall onto the deportee's window. A dragonfly is born. The German extends his large hands. Poor haiku poet. Into the night he chases the firefly that got away. Without my lover, the wilted leaves fall, pile up on the green lawn. Moth under the light, at no time do I forget my country. Butterflies entwined, my wife and children are far away, flashed across my mind. Under the blazing sun, I have come to a country far from the sea. Days have passed in the indigo of the sky. The willow seed heads have disappeared. When I talk to the broken-hearted German, red poppies. Upon learning about the atomic bombing, my father writes this. A lamp moth flies suddenly. I wanted to see my child's photo. Under the scorching sun, on and on, I curse this arrogant country. I live in a country without love, where the roses are red. Furious thunder, birds hiding in the trees flow out crazily. Furious thunder, roll over and crush the people of this nation. Tearing the sky, the lightning rises up on the horizon. Wilted leaves have fallen, the doves go on crying. Autumn grief, unbearable, I look at the children's photo. Crawling out of the fire onto the mowed grass, poor crickets. In the field where Chinese milk vetches bloom, the iron fence slices the road. Nothing cures my grief. I linger around the poppies. Night laundry. I was with a man talking about loneliness. The war has ended. Not a day's gone by this summer that I've held a weapon in my skinny arms. To those parting, I raise my hot autumn hand. Repatriation or release. The morning glows on the snow. And the last one. This thing called repatriation, fear lives in my mind. The days grow longer in some windows, waiting for the hearing, afraid. The war has ended, but I'm still in the snow country prison. And we are reunited in Crystal City and moved to Cincinnati, Ohio. And Itaru passed away at the age of 64 in 1977, and Shizuko passed away at the age of 82 in 2000. Thank you.
We got acquainted at a wonderful exhibit up at Fort Lincoln, and your brother came to that as well, mm-hmm. And could you tell us what the name of that exhibition was, featuring photos by a German PO, actually was in the internment camp there, and then your father's haiku.
It was called Snow Country Prison.
Okay, Snow Country Prison, which you just had there at the end. Look that up. There's still, I think, some material on that on the internet. It's beautiful, so it's great. Thanks a lot. Okay, our third presenter is Mako Nakagawa, and she came in here steaming today. She's She's been making presentations all day, and she's getting kind of tired. But Mako was born in 1937 in Seattle, and she spent her pre-war childhood in Seattle. And then when the war broke out, she was not taken screaming and hollering and kicking to Puyallup, but she might have been. But in any event, like a lot of the people from the Washington area, they left Puyallup and they went to Minidoka in Idaho. And eventually she ended up joining with her father and I guess you and the rest of your family that was at Minidoka went over to the family camp at Crystal City. So all three of you were Crystal City folks at some time. So, but one of the things that is memorable about Mako is what occurred at the quick hearings in 1981 in Seattle, because she had helped prepare her father and basically were sort of the ears for her father, who at that time was pretty much deaf, wasn't he, your dad? And so she was his support, and she gave voice to his voice then, as she's doing right now. And she's been working in recent years, and she has a background as a teacher, and she's now just a public teacher. She was in public schools teaching, and she taught, and she was a principal, and she dealt with multicultural education. She later was president of the Seattle chapter of the JCL, and she was particularly vital in a committee called the Power of Words Committee, and this focused on the importance of using the correct terminology and everything, so you don't use evacuation, so Roger Daniels doesn't come down on you. Okay, so with that, Mako, it's all yours.
Thank you. Where'd you get all that information? My goodness. Is it okay if I stand up? I'm an elementary school teacher. I don't know how to sit down and teach, share anything. Oh, I'm still breathing hard over hearing the both of my, you know, fellow panelists. You know, his father is officiated my wedding. He officiated my father's funeral. The first guy I was in crush, well, I was crushed, you know, I had a, you know, what is it, a crush on. Yeah, that was his brother. And that was in Crystal City. Because in Crystal City, we used to go see movies, and you could tell a guy that's on a date because he has two chairs. And he puts it down. But, boy, our paths have crossed so much that I could talk about my family progression, and it's about really fits in beautifully. My father went to Missoula, to Louisiana, to Santa Fe, to Crystal City. Followed your father. Yeah, and oh my goodness, there's time and time again, the things they say go bing, bing, bing in my head. That's all I'm thinking about. My parents did not write letters of any extent. They did not keep a diary. They did not write beautiful poetry. So maybe I got nothing to say. I forgot what I was going to say. I know where I'll start. I'll start here. We were in Minidoka, and then we got word that we're going to finally get a chance to get reunited with my father. And my two older sisters were just happier in hell, you know. And really, 2 year separation. I just turned 5 when Dad was taken away. And by the time that we were alerted that we're going to be reunited with my father, I don't remember him that well. You know, 2 years, my memory faded. And I was kind of jealous that my sisters was talking all about him, what a wonderful thing it was. And actually, by the time that we got to Crystal City, it was hot and dusty and boring, and you know, they had the bus seats like this, and they put boards across it, and they had us little kids sit on that, and they would put splinters in your bottom, you know. And it was mom tried to keep us interested by saying, okay, what do you see outside the window, you know. And it finally got into the camp itself, and you know, mom says, who's going to be the first person that finds Dad, you know. So we were looking around, and I thought I would be first, because, you know, mom had the picture of my father sitting right next to the apple box that she put dad's picture on, and he was so spiffy looking, so I knew that I would, because all the other men coming to the bus, you know, were straggly looking, you know, so I knew that I was going to find dad first, you know. Then my sister said, there he is, there's Papa, so I'm looking around for Papa. And here comes a scruffy old man, you know, like all the rest of the scruffy, and I was so disappointed, you know. I was, oh my, I thought my dad was really special. And then my sister, my little baby sister, she learned a speech that she was going to make for Papa. Otousan, watakushi wa midori desu, ookiku natta desho. Dad, I'm midori, didn't I get big, you know. And she practiced that over and over and over again until it was ad nauseum, okay. But she delivered it pretty well for my father. And so we clapped for her. She was really happy, but she was really, you know, she did not want this guy in our life, you know, just get him away from us, you know. And she used to run away from him whenever she can. And I was really envious of her. I wanted to run away too, but I was too old and sophisticated. But this, we're all looking forward to this day that we're going to get, you know, and my sister's running away and I'm kind of looking at my dad like that. Ooh, but Crystal was very different, very different. For one, my mom, who was, I think my mom actually was worried that she was not going to live and she was going to leave four girls, you know, in an orphanage. So she really was hell-bent on getting back together so she could, you know, have my father take care of us. And then by the time we got reunited, she was just so happy. She was, I never saw her so bouncy and, you know, smiling. And, you know, I always thought kind of a tired, sick, you know, laid back, you know, woman. She just turned a whole different personality. She was fun. I enjoyed her, you know, and I didn't want to share her with dad, you know. But see, after 2 years in Idaho, in Crystal, we actually had a toilet that belonged to us and our neighbor. Our neighbor had five people in it, and we had six. So 11 of us shared this one toilet. But we thought that was marvelous, you know. We had our own toilet just about. We cooked our own meals. You know, we went to the store, and I mean, what they call the store, and brought our food home, and we ate as a family. I didn't like that because I used to leave my vegetables. I hated vegetables. Vegetables are for rabbits, okay? And now that I have to eat with a family, my mother sat me down and made me eat my vegetables, and I still hate vegetables. But, you know, the family unit was much more intact. You didn't eat with your friends, and, you know, the adults ate by themselves. And so there was a feeling of family. There was a feeling of community. We are the only camp that had a swimming pool. Woo, you guys would have loved the swimming pool. I loved it. It was so hot in Texas that you just can't get along without it. Did you go swimming a lot? And yeah, wasn't that fun? And so my memories of Texas was full of good thoughts. My mom and dad were so much happy. In fact, one of the first things my mom and dad talked about was, in Crystal City, this new camp that we're in, they call us Mr. Takahashi and Mrs. Takahashi, you know? It was like it was some big deal. Well, it was for them because they were not called by their title when they were, before they went to Crystal. I learned that and that the reason why we had so much better things for us in Crystal was that if in case, and it looked like we might be exchanged for soldiers, and we'll get American soldiers back home to the United States, they'll use us as bodies, exchange bodies. And if we had bad things to say about our incarceration, then maybe they'll treat their American prisoners pretty poorly also. So I'm told that that had a lot to do with our better treatment. But come on, it still was a prison, you know. We had a lot more luxury than we did in Minidoka, but it still was a prison. You could not walk out anytime you wanted, you know. It was a lot nicer. It was a lot nicer. And they were much more patriotic. We went to American schools, and pledged a flag and everything else. And then after Japan, I mean, American school, we went to Japanese school. I learned to poetry in Japanese, you know. Wow. Every day you go to American school, then you go to Japanese school. And then on Saturday, Japan school still continues on Saturday, so you go to Saturday school. And on Sunday, we went to Reverend Ichikawa's Sunday school. And so we went to school every day of the week. And as much as we were proud to be Americans in the morning, in the afternoon, they told us to say banzai so loud that Japan could hear, you know. And I'm looking at the desert, miles and miles of desert, and I'm thinking, could Japan really hear us if I scream loud enough, you know? It was very interesting, you know. There didn't seem to be any conflict at the fact that we were rooting for both Japan and we were rooting for America. I didn't know the difference. I did think that there was something strange about the, and in fact, I don't know if I, this was the enemy. I was in part of a breakout session earlier, and this is, what was it? That we look like the enemy?
Looking like the enemy.
Looking like the enemy? Well, I thought the enemy looked like this. I didn't think I looked like this. You know, this is looking like the enemy. And I'm thinking, to me, when I was in camp, there was two groups of people. One was Nihonjin. I was part of that. And the other was Hakujin. And you had to be nice and smile and be polite to the Hakujins, but get away as soon as you can. Don't mess around, you know, because they got the, you know, you got the sense that they're in power. So when we were in Minidoka, we had a small number of families that were being escorted to go to Crystal City. And so I have a story. Were any of you in the session earlier when looking like the enemy? Oh, no. Oh, okay. I'll try to come up with a different story then. Okay. This one here is the trip to Crystal. I call this the naked eye look. After almost two long, hard years in Puyallup and Minidoka without Papa, our family was alerted that we were to be transferred to another concentration camp, this one called Crystal City in Texas. In Texas, okay. We were to be reunited with Papa at last. My older two sisters were delighted with the news, and they began sharing Papa stories. It was hard for me to remember much about my father. However, the trip to Texas itself provided unforgettable trip. A number of armed military guards were assigned to escort the group of families, including us, who were being transferred to Texas. Initially, the guards asserted their authority by brandishing their rifles, insulting some of the group by their tough tones and giving their orders, and constantly counting us to make sure no one escaped. Mama, along with the other members of the group, bristled at the rudeness of them pointing to us and counting us off verbally. That's the way they count pigs in Japan, they lamented. The counting style disturbed the older Japanese more than us younger ones of Japanese descent. It must be old country culture, my sister commented. By the time we reached the train station in Portland, the guards relaxed their attitude with the repetitive counting of the members. They even gave us some time to roam around in the station. They made sure that everyone knew the time and the place where we are going to regroup. My two older sisters were given Mama's permission to climb up the huge staircase up to the very top and then look down upon us in the main station area. My sisters were provided private time away from the scrutiny of the guards and from Mama. Mama was probably wise in relieving my sisters of having me tag along, but I was not happy about being excluded from this wonderful adventure. I was even more disappointed when they came back and gloated about the view that they had of us from so high above. We looked like ants, they vowed. They they gloated as they viewed us from above. They said we look like ants. I vowed that one day, I too will one day will be able to look down from a place so high that people will look like ants. Mama delegated responsibility of the care for the youngest sister, the three-year-old Minky, to my older sisters and invited me to go to the ladies' room. Well, this was not much of a consolation, but I was happy to go somewhere. As I walked with Mama, away with Mama, out of nowhere, a woman jumped out and called Mama a dirty Jap and spit on her. She glared at Mama with eyes full of anger and hate. Those eyes shifted to me. I clearly saw in her eyes what I today call the naked eye look. When her eyes met mine, I thought I saw a flicker. I thought that flicker was maybe from her embarrassment of having a child observe her appalling antics. But in that split second, Mama took my hand and we continued on to the ladies' room. I thought Mama didn't realize that she was spit upon until I saw her quietly go and take a paper towel, proceed directly to the spot where the spit had landed on her coat. After she thoroughly cleaned her coat, she threw away the towel. She swooped down and looked intensely into my eyes for long seconds. That look meant that I was never to talk about what I had witnessed. It was like it never happened. And the joy of seeing Papa filled my head again. It was not till long after Mama passed away that I even recalled this incident. Since the day in Portland, I have been to many high places and peered down to look at people that look like ants, another commonplace experience in the city. Frankly, looking down on people from high places is not my favorite activity. Certainly, it lacks the thrill that I imagined so many years ago, but that naked eye look, that's something, that same day, that's another story. That look and my response to it was beyond reason, beyond description. Maybe you have to experience it to know how it feels. You can understand looking like an ant. You cannot understand looking like whatever that woman saw. I have twice seen that naked eye look as a grown woman. Once I attended a desegregation meeting where a white mother adamantly spoke against sending her child to a central area school. Another time was when I saw the same emotions in the eyes of a man who was speaking publicly for the first time about the homosexuality of his own son. I really don't know where that look comes from. Is it hate or fear or revulsion or something else I never felt for myself? Whatever it was, that naked eye look had immense power and is chillingly frightful to me. I think Mama will forgive me now for sharing the story from the train depot so many years ago. It may even please her that the story is being shared. Okay. Okay. Let me read you a funny one then. Okay. This is The Strange Benjo and Piala. Okay. I was fascinated by the newfangled latrine installed in Puyallup. It was a contraption. It was quite a contraption and an improvement over the smelly outhouses. A big bucket sat high off the floor with water running into it. When it became heavy enough to outweigh the counterbalance, it would come crashing down. And on its downward fall, the bucket would get tripped. That was when the spectacle began. Gushing water would fill a trough running under the length of a long bench. The bench itself had a half a dozen holes on top. These holes were designed for people to sit on and take care of their bodily needs. This was the first and only toilet I have ever seen that flushed horizontally. At regular intervals, the roaring water will rush through the trough and pick up debris deposited from the holes. To avoid the spray caused by the force of the water, anyone using the first hole in the bench had to time his or her use of the two periods between the flushes. To a five-year-old, this was a contraption seemed like a marvel in mechanical ingenuity. The power of the roaring water produced a sense of wondrous adventure in me. there was no partition anywhere in the Atchulin area. Each user had to wait, including those waiting for their turn, had full view of everyone else. It was only pressing need that overcame modesty. Some women even brought cardboard boxes to give themselves some modicum of privacy. I heard the adults being humiliated, but I was unaffected. I thought it strange that I alone was entranced by the operation itself, but I was taught bathroom etiquette befitting the circumstances. While sitting, I avoided eye contact and did not acknowledge any people I knew. Some of the older girls were giggling about the obasans, the grandmothers, who often wiped themselves by leaning forward and reaching between their legs. Ooh, how embarrassing. I laughed at the breach of manners as well as the mental picture, but I was guilty of breaking the code from time to time with surreptitious glances. But I did something much worse. My curiosity drove me into actually looking into the hole while the water was gushing. I was shocked to see toilet tissue soaked in blood passing by. There was only one young woman sitting to my right. I recognized her as a beautiful lady who was always nice, even to us little kids. How tragic to think she was dying of some terrible disease, causing her to bleed so profusely. I quietly tailed after her for some time. I could not believe her upbeat disposition. She was acting as if nothing was wrong. She smiled and talked to people cheerfully. I knew I would never be able to do that were I in her circumstance. How courageous, how dignified. I tried to keep her secret, but I finally blurted it out to my very best friend. When she found out how I learned about this tragedy, she broke out in peals of laughter. She called me naive, which is a word I never heard before. She took a deep breath. She explained that blood on toilet tissue is not a sign of imminent death. She took a deep breath and went on to say, it simply was the result of a person eating too much beets. Needless to say, I never ate beets again. It was not much of a sacrifice. I never liked beets anyway. Thank you.
Now you have experienced Mako Unplugged. I want to open it up to the group out here for some questions or comments, whatever you want to do. Okay. So just raise your hand and I'll call. Yes.
Were you in Area C by any chance?
C? Appeal.
I thought A was the one right across the street from the main gate.
Oh, no, I was in there, but the toilet is exactly
the same. Thank you. Do you like beets?
That's a personal question.
Anybody else? Comment? Go to the microphone because we're getting you on.
Oh, yep. I have a quick question.
Well, ask the question on the microphone. Okay. Oh, I'll help you. I'll help you. Come on.
Thank you.
Well, can't you just bring the microphone to her? There.
Oh, yeah.
Good. All right. Good.
Thank you. My question is, and I was born at camp, but they talk about the classes that were held. Who were the teachers? Were they trained teachers, or was it just people that volunteered to be teachers, or how did that work? I never did ask that before or understand how that worked.
I understand that they first used people that had any kind of interest or any kind of background in education, but later on they did get actual teachers from the community. So they were white teachers, and the Japanese teachers ended up being aides instead. But there were people that actually had teaching certification, but they won't be hired by the school systems. So it took a long while before they actually hired a person. Yes, in fact. The first person of Japanese ancestry that was a teacher for the Seattle schools was still a teacher when I became a teacher, so it's not long. Okay.
Other questions?
Is that Tosh?
I don't know if I missed something, but I was just wondering, my parents were in living in Honolulu when the war broke out, and they were never interned to a camp or anything like that. But her older brother, who lived about a half a mile from my parents, was interned to Crystal City. So how did they decide to choose him to go into Crystal City and not my parents or anybody else?
Can I answer that? Yeah, go ahead. Do you have an answer?
No,
oh, okay.
If you know the answer.
I'll make it up. It depends on what kind of information that the FBI had, and they were collecting information way before Pearl Harbor. So if they were Buddhist ministers, if they were Japanese language teachers or administration or whatever, if they were Shintoist, they probably would have been picked up. But when they were apprehended, there was never any warrant, so we didn't know specifically what was the problem. But usually those things, if they were part of a leader of unions, you know, stuff like that, if they were sending money back to Japan that supposedly was helping their military, or something like that. But there was no way of finding out. My father was taken, and his father, but his father was a Buddhist. That must mean something terrible, you know.
Satoru's interview with Dencho has a really interesting thing that relates to this conference, because one of the things we're doing in this conference is focusing on the 25th anniversary of Redress. And one of his close friends at camp was Edison Uno, at Crystal City, who was considered to be the father of Redress. And the Uno family ended up probably being the last family to ever leave Crystal City, and it didn't leave till about 1949. Is that right? Was it before that?
I think it was about 47.
47?
Yeah.
And he was speculating in the interview whether there was a relationship between the fact that they were kept there so long and Edison Uno being so concerned about Redress and because they were wronged so monstrously. So, and then you said that his dad has a hobby, a taxidermist, wasn't he? Edison's dad?
Yes, I was a very good friend of Edison Uno. We went to school together. We're classmates. He'd pick me up in the morning, you know, and we'd walk all the way to the Federal High School in Crystal City. And Edison, of course, was in camp long after everybody else had left. And I'm sorry that I didn't keep some of the letters that he mailed to me, but it wasn't a good part of 1947 that he was still sending letters out to me. Yeah.
That question about the education at the camps, there are two excellent volumes that I have read over the years about the education at the Crystal City camp. And it's a complex thing because there were multiple school systems within Crystal City, and they're laid out really nicely, both written by educators. So I think, you know, if you'd like to find out more about that, just go on the Internet and put Education Crystal City, and you'll find those two volumes.
This is more of a comment, but my father's first family were Kibe, and of course in the camps, you know, when we had that loyalty oath questionnaire, one of my older brothers was violently against it, and I was the other way, and we almost got in a physical fight over that. But today, very interestingly, they never told me what happened in Tule Lake. You know, one of my brothers was apparently in this organization that you just mentioned, Hoshidan, that I never heard of. So I'm very much interested and appreciative of coming and hearing this, because they never told me anything, and I never asked them. And they weren't very proud of it, about it anyway. So my comment is I'm very thankful that I heard this, and maybe I can pursue that a little further. Thank you.
Other questions?
Just a comment about that, too, is that the fact that people didn't talk about it was part of an effort to suppress the fact that there was dissidence at Tule Lake, mm-hmm. and that the Hoshidan was categorized as a pro-Japan loyalist, violent, disloyal people. And in fact, there was some of that. But the most of the group were dissidents. They were opposing the mistreatment that they were experiencing. They were demanding justice and organized, and then eventually gave up hope that they could reach that in America. So many of them, 6,000 from Tule Lake, renounced their citizenship, saying that, you know, there was no hope. So it probably did, because one of the things they were looking for, they asked, is that if you have any sibling that is in the military at the time, have them write a letter on your behalf, and it will help with the early release. Yeah. Yeah, I have my uncle's letter because he was in the MIS and wrote a letter for my parents. Yeah.
Okay, a quick question. Virtually everybody I've heard who was sent to one of these so-called justice camps was moved repeatedly. Any of the panel members or Art, can you give us any reason, or did your parents ever give any reasons why they were moved repeatedly from prison camp to prison camp?
Part of the agreement that they were operating under was that they had to have individual hearings. Now, the individual hearings ended up to be more of a Gestapo hearing almost, you know, but that was required. And after that hearing, then the administration decides on whether they are loyal enough to send back to wherever they came from or retain them. And so that's one of the reasons why they're moved around.
My father was actually picked up in March of 43. Most dads, you know, were picked up a lot quicker than that. So he had his little satchel ready to go any time that the FBI came after him. And when they did come after him, and he was sent over to the Immigration and Naturalization Building on Airport Way, they found that there weren't any more rooms for him. So they sent him home again. So he spent one more night at home.
I think one of the reasons they moved around quite a bit were those camps were not open the whole time. They were open for a while, and they closed them down, and then they moved the population to another facility. And then eventually the last move is what people were hoping for all along, was to have some kind of reunion with their families. And so Crystal City is where they all ended up, and all of them went on. All of your family members went on an odyssey through the camps. Right. So,
and the one important thing to distinguish, the Department of Justice internment camps were – these were federal prison camps to hold enemy aliens. And this was international law that if your country went to war with another country and you were living in that country and a citizen of the enemy country, you could be held as an enemy alien in the prison camp. So the WRA camps, and so those internment camps were governed by the Geneva Convention. And so the quality of living and standard of activity and services and all sanitation and social activities was all governed by the international law. Where the WRA camps were internal prison camps with no outside requirement of quality of life. So many of the men who were taken from the WRA camp, separated from the families and put into internment camps, wrote about the fact that their life was better in the internment camps.
Keep in mind that part of the Geneva Convention was to have a neutral power oversee that these camps were being operated according to the regulations. So the Spanish Council made periodic visits or could make a visit just because they were asked to make a visit by the population there, that they were registering the fact that they had been mistreated and they wanted it to be inspected. And so that happened. So there was always that situation.
But we in the WRA camps were supposed to be protected by the United States Constitution. And it says life, liberty, and property is supposed to be sacred and it cannot be taken away from us without due process of law, okay? So it's the Constitution that let us down. was supposed to be protected. And then the people that were doing the translation during the DOJ camps, a lot of them turned out to be Koreans who had a lot of animosity against the Japanese because of the occupation in Korea, which, you know, is complicated. But the thing is, there is accounts that she was talking about, you know, some physical ways of beating up on them, punishing people. There is accounts of people in Missoula that were pretty, their teeth knocked out and pretty bad physical confrontations.
Well, we don't want to leave this by thinking that the Constitution let us down. It was the people that interpret it or tried to implement it, et cetera, that let us down.
Did not stand up for it. Yeah.
I think, is there still some remnant of Crystal City there where you can go and be able to see it interpreted and the like? Has anybody been to Crystal City? It's one of the few camps I haven't been to. So.
I was there.
My brother visited Crystal City a few years ago, and there's very little left of the camp. There's a big water tank that's sitting on the field and the remnants of the old swimming pool.
Yeah.
There is a memorial plaque that was erected by residents of Crystal City sitting close to the school that is now, that was built close to the Crystal City site.
I've been at three different conferences where they showed a film that was put out about Crystal City, and it seemed very idealistic when I was looking at it. Did you, any of the three of you see that film, and what was your take on it?
No, I just saw the Crystal City Popeye statue. I heard of the Popeye statue because Crystal City is a self-exposed spinach capital of the world, and I really want to see, you know, the statue of Popeye. I thought that'd be just so much fun to see, but I never got to see it. So years or decades later, when I went back to Crystal, I wanted to see this Popeye's, and it was there.
I don't know about answering your question, but I just wanted to clarify: the swimming pool was not designed and developed for recreation for the internees. It happened to be a holding tank for water that they were convinced, that the administration was convinced to allow the prisoners there at different times of the year to use as a swimming pool. So we didn't have lifeguards and jackets.
There's one up here and then one over here, okay? Yeah, I know. They got started late because of technical difficulties. Go ahead.
My name is Sid Okazaki, and I'm probably one of the older ones with the IRR. That we were probably 18 years old. And the one thing about the swimming pool, we dug it out by our hands, by spade. There was we dug it out, I don't know how long it was there, but it's an irrigation, like you mentioned, okay? And the community wanted a swimming pool. So actually, when all the younger sets went daily in the hot sun, and we dug it out by shovel and picks. So that's why you got a nice swimming pool.
Thank you. Thank you.
And like I say, Sat Ichikawa, and I know his brother and his other family. So, and we lived in, like you say, in a duplex. It's duplex is one in the center with a
one bench on two rocks. Yeah.
But then we had an old cooking stove and that type of thing. Oh. And so we had bunk beds for it. And Sat has come up with the children's
books. Yeah, he did. That's great.
That signifies how for the children to you know, how the life in Crystal City was. Okay. If there's any other questions, I can probably answer. I went to, since I graduated Gila, Arizona before I got to Crystal City. Most of my education was in Japanese school. Oh. So The Japanese school, of course, was run by ministers and professional people. Therefore, I had, I guess I could say I started my Japanese language, of which I can speak squishy bit right now. But
you keep it up, you're going to be interpreting those letters for him.
Yeah, not really. But we did have the complete, meaning calligraphy and Chinese language, grammar, and of course the history and so forth.
Thank you very, very much. You had one last question. Wait for the...
My mother's family was brought to Canfra and then Topaz, but then apparently her father was asked by the government to teach Japanese to the American soldiers, and he said, only if I can bring my family. And so they granted that, and so that he was able to pull his family out and go to Michigan to teach the American soldiers. So I was just wondering, why was he so lucky? I mean, he asked for something and he got it, and so many other fathers were taken away from the family. So I'm just wondering what kind of
factors. Well, it's just like the Kibbe were so discriminated against, except the Kibbe had talents that the United States needed. The stars of the military intelligence service were almost all Kibbe, and that, in addition to that, the Kibbe, even the people that you know, renounced their citizenship once they got to Japan, and then all of a sudden the army over there realized when the war is over, they realize these have the exact talents we need. They know Japanese culture, they know Japanese language, and a lot of them ended up being, you know, inducted, I mean, recruited for the army, and they retired with careers in the army. These were the ones who were the most heinous, you know, sort of victims, the looking like the enemy. I mean, they were the ones that they made look most like the enemy. So it's really quite an irony. So I think that the reason is that there was talent there that they wanted to be able to exploit for, you know, national defense purposes. Other questions? Okay, I'd like to thank the audience, but I'd especially like to thank the panel. And thanks for bringing the words of your parents to a larger audience. Okay.